Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the Information Service here in Geneva at the United Nations. Today is Tuesday, 5th of November. We have, une fois n'est pas coutume, a short briefing. And it's WHO who is taking us all this news. And so I would like to start immediately with Dr. Rick Papercorn, the representative for occupied Palestinian territory for WHO, who is joining in from Gaza. Dr. Papercorn, you have the floor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me?
We can, very well. Thank you.
Okay, so good morning and greetings from Gaza. I want to start with two topics. I want to first focus in health in the north of Gaza, and I mean the north of Gaza, north of Gaza City. And then I want to focus on the polio and the polio campaign. So in October, WHO actually planned many missions to the north. And as you know, not only the health missions, but also other missions, also WHO, many of these WHO missions were canceled or impeded. That was also applicable for the other sectors. Still, over the last 3 weeks, and I mean this, you know, this current mission is more than 3.5 weeks. Over the last 3 weeks, the WHO managed 7 missions to the north. 5 missions were specifically to Kamalat 1, and yes, the day before yesterday, actually also Al-Ada, that was the last mission there. I participated in 4 of those missions, and we had also 2 other large missions to Gaza City. So this WHO missions is always have kind of the same objective, to deliver fuel, medical supplies, blood units, and if we are allowed, also some food for patients and some food and water for patients and staff. Then with our partners of Palestinian Red Cross Society in Qatar, in the last of these 5 missions, we internally medevaced 109 critical patients, I think it's even 110 critical patients, and 111 caregivers to Shifa, and some of them to the south. We also facilitated and supported some of the emergency medical teams to hospitals when feasible. And it's not feasible now anymore in the north, the north Gaza, but for example, 2 emergency medical teams were brought to Shifa, another one to Al-Ahli Hospital. Tomorrow, we plan with partners for a large medevac, over 100 patients, we'll get the details tomorrow, critical patients outside Gaza. But I wanna share some specifics on the situation in the north. So for example, the day before yesterday, when we again reached Kamalat 1 on 3 November, say 7 mission in 2-3 weeks. So we managed, despite dire conditions, to get medical supplies in for 7,000 intervention, 150 units of blood, 20,000 liters of fuel, 60 boxes of dry food, etc. And we transferred then 25 patients and 37 companions. Intense bombardments close to the hospital and also close to the mission. You might have heard about that. And actually close to the convoy as well. Well, shortly after WHO mission to Kamalat 1, and when we had departed, it was reported that the facility was hit then again. So that is again 2 days ago on the third floor, and 6 children were reportedly, 6 patients were reportedly injured. If you look at the situation at Kamalat 1, 3 medical doctors remaining, 2 pediatricians, 1 general physician, 30 nurses, and 120 patients. The needs are enormous, and specifically they ask for emergency medical teams. They need a surgeon, general surgeon, orthopedic surgeon, and vascular surgeon. The emergency department is full of patients, more than 40 casualties as we counted. So when we were there, and all our former missions, we also saw numerous emergency wards flooded sometimes with trauma cases and casualties, and a lack of let's say the right staff to treat many of those trauma cases. The inpatient part was also full of hospitalized patients and their caregivers. In Al-Ada, which is just a few blocks away, difficult to reach, we transferred 5 patients and 5 caregivers. I want to make the point here. It's very important. So the hospital has no fuel, very little fuel left. Generator was only operating for 3 hours. It's stopped now. They ration it very much. 44 patients, and five of them we took out, critical patient. 71 staff, 11 medical doctors. They have a surgeon and they can operate. They have a lot of trauma burden, 79 injuries on the 2nd of November, 69 injuries on the 3rd of November. Currently, no surgical operation could take place due to lack of electricity. So we were not, WHO was not facilitators. We put in this request time and again to bring medical and surgical supplies and medications for approximately 1,000 interventions to deliver 10,000 liters of fuel, deliver food and water, you know, and 50 units of blood. For unclear reasons, we were not facilitated. This, we were also wanted to bring in some polio vaccines for both hospitals to at least cover the children around. There are still children around. We weren't allowed to bring in the, or we're not facilitated to bring in the polio vaccines. Alada, we're very concerned because the hospital needs this urgent fuel and medical supplies. Otherwise, it might become non-functional in over the coming week. We plan to resupply this hospital later the week. And just to describe, both directors, the director of Dr. Alada, Dr. Mohammed, he was desperate and also really disappointed with us because he said he had heard we would bring fuel and supplies and we only, and not just Medevac, his critical patients. There are three hospitals to describe the north of Gaza. There's three hospitals in the north of Gaza, Kamalat 1, Alada, and Indonesian hospital. Indonesian hospital is not functional. And Kamalat 1 and Alada are minimum functional. There are no functional primary healthcare centers or medical points in the north of Gaza. So the overall health situation in the north, with still an estimated population of 75,000 people, very difficult to estimate. A lot of people, the estimation is 150,000 people left. But it's, if we're left, were forcibly evacuated and fled. But it is critically, it's vital that these hospitals remain functional. And what the Dr. Hussam, the director of Kamalat 1, he described very well. He said, what I really want and need is, first of all, protection of the hospital, the staff, facility. And the second, I want WHO, as you try to do, and partners to come in regularly, deliver the regular supplies of fuel, medical supplies, blood and food for patients, staff, and assist with an EMT. So again, I want to make that point. It's all about access. WHO and partners, we are ready to do so. What we need is regular access, not just ad hoc access, regular access, and that we can properly and access which should be properly supported and facilitated and not made unnecessarily dangerous. And in that sense, I would say all my colleagues, we sound like a broken record into 1 year into this crisis. But it's a small ask with a key impact. Now, let's now shift to polio. So, and let's not forget why we are doing this and what the target was. So the campaign aims to vaccinate an estimated 591,000 children under 10 years of age. And this time with the second dose, because the first round was done 5 weeks ago. A second dose of novel oral polio vaccine type 2. Also, in this whole, the second round, vitamin A has been co-administered alongside the polio vaccine to help boost the overall immunity of children between the ages of 2 and 9 years. We had successful implementation of the first two phases in the central and southern Gaza, which reached more than 451,000 children and more than 364,000 children with vitamin A. And that was more than 95% of the target. So against many odds, successful. We know that a campaign in the north was compromised. The technical committee, which is the Ministry of Health, WHO, UNICEF, UNRWA, and the NGO partners, they decided to postpone from 23 October until the 2nd of November due to the lack of access, the lack of assured comprehensive humanitarian pauses, the intense bombardments, and the mass evacuation orders. Also, because the area-specific humanitarian pause, that area related to the humanitarian pause was substantially reduced compared to the first round. It is mainly the broader Gaza City and excluded the north of Gaza. And we initially estimated we would miss at least 15,000 children. However, as we know, that over the last few weeks, estimation is 150,000 people have been forced to evacuate from North Gaza toward Gaza City and flats, etc. So it's difficult to really estimate what amount of children, you know, we would miss. The committee decided to go ahead after that delay and to do our level best and to cover as many kids as possible. So the target for the north was 119,000 children. And between the 2nd and the 4th of November, so yesterday, more than 105,261 under 10 year have been vaccinated, and almost 84,000 children provided vitamin A. That's actually 88% of the target. It's exceptionally, I think it's an exceptional achievement, but it shows even when I went around, I visited many sites, primary healthcare facilities, but also, for example, a playground, Yarmouk playgrounds, and orphanage centers, which are all shelters for thousands, literally thousands of internally displaced people. And we met so many families who had fled from the north. I was recognized, Stephen. It was painful, and also some of that happy encounters by so many men and women and children from my four visits to Kamala One, and that after that last siege, they were forced to leave. So currently today, there is still some polio activities going on four fixed sites in the north. Tomorrow, the post-campaign monitoring will start, and based on the post-campaign monitoring, we have a really good overview of the final coverage. And of course, we will only know after weeks, after months, etc., how successful this has been. But I think overall, I think I really want to thank the Ministry of Health. I mean, like all the organizations, the WHO, UNICEF, UNRWA, but the many NGO partners, and specifically, of course, those teams on the ground, because also in the north, we talked, for example, about more than 205 teams, many fixed sites, many mobile teams, and every day the committee analyzed and came together. For example, on day two and three, they decided to have more mobile teams doing their work because it was way more effective. I think because of this large displacement from the north, we have done relatively better with regard to polio, which is cynical. One thing I want to also ask, when I met those families in the north, and they were in all these makeshift camps, for example, on this playground and other things, there's an absolute need to improve the shelter, and the shelter conditions are horrible. There's a need of water and food, and the rains have not yet started. But if you think about what will happen when the rains would start, it will be horrific. So there's an absolute need for shelter, for more shelter activities, and actually work in all sector. And there is a consistent need for access everywhere, specifically to the north of Gaza. But I want to stress again, we, as WHO and partners, we focus to assist and make sure that essential health services are functional, even if it is minimal functional or partly functional. That is our main aim. The polio campaign was just an important component. And maybe let me close with a small positive note. If you look, for example, at Shifa Medical Complex, and everybody who has witnessed Shifa over the time and being largely destroyed and damaged, etc., and becoming non-functional, Currently, Shifa is like a mini hospital again. It has an emergency department, it has functional operation theaters, it has a general surgeon, vascular surgeon, orthopedic surgeon, 9 to 15 major operations per day. And this is the place where we now refer, it's again working as we refer the more critical patients. It also has a unit in the middle of the rubble of a hemodialysis unit with 25 machines operational, and it used to be 60, but providing service twice a week for 63 patients. There's war going on. WHO supports the EMT through the emerging medical team, helping Shifa through MAP UK providing supplies. There's war going on with other partners to look at neonatology and to the MCA services. So it's a small positive in I would say, in this crisis. Over to you.
Questions now in the room. Nina Larsson, AFP.
There's a lot of details, so I had a few questions for you. First, I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about the large medevac that you're planning tomorrow. It was a little unclear to me. I think you said you're planning to take over 100 patients out of Gaza. Could you explain how that's going to happen and give more details on that? Maybe I misunderstood, but if you could provide some more details. And then on Kamalad 1, I think you mentioned more than 40 casualties had been counted. Are you talking about people who have died? Are you talking about including injuries? And if you could give, if you have more details on that, including the recent days of strikes on the hospital, that would be helpful. And then just on the polio campaign, there was an attack on a polio center on Saturday, I think. If you could, do you have more details on what happened there and how many people were injured, if you have any more details on that now? I'll start with that. Thanks.
Okay. Let me first say something about the medevac for tomorrow, and I also need to get the details. For the medevac of tomorrow, that's we talk over 100 patients. I think it's even 113 or something like that, and the larger group of patients. So what's happening? So these patients are prioritized. They are on the Ministry of Health priority list. WHO helps to get these patients to, for example, to one location, and it's an enormous amount of work, and also from the north to the south and from the various hospitals. Tonight they will be gathered at the European Gaza Hospital, and tomorrow, and from 6 in the morning, that's the plan, they will be brought to Kerem Shalom, and then across, and then from Kerem Shalom they will go to Ramon Airport, and the majority of the patient will go to the UAE. We've done this before, I mean, I think, and then I think something like 13 patients will go to Romania. So that is plans for tomorrow. I think I want to say something about this whole medevac. So since the Rafah crossing has been closed, this is since the 6th of May, so before that there was close to 4,700 patients had been medevaced outside Gaza, and WHO helped to facilitate that. But since that, we only had 282 patients medevaced out of Gaza, and the majority facilitated and by WHO, and a lot of them to the UAE, which I really want to thank as a part. And so this is another medevac. Again, largely to the UAE, but also some European countries expressed interest to receive patients from Gaza, critical patients. So a small group will also move to Romania, as I said. Tomorrow we can provide you with more details of that. Now, on the medevac, though, we see this as very good initiative, but it's ad hoc. And so, of course, by the way, WHO gathers all these patients together tonight in European Gaza, and then with our partners, I have to mention them, the Palestinian Red Crescent Society and CARITAS, we will move all these patients. It's a huge convoy to Kerem Shalom. These are ad hoc measures. What we have been requesting for repeatedly, we need a sustained medevac outside Gaza, a better organized, sustained medevac. So we estimate that approximately 12 and 14,000 critical patients need to be medevac. Half of them probably trauma related, et cetera, all the serious trauma cases, think amputation, six spinal cord injuries, burns, et cetera. But the other half is also a chronic case, oncology, et cetera. For that, we cannot continue the way we do now. We need medical corridors. And the first medical corridors we have repeatedly requested to be restored is the traditional referral pathway from Gaza to East Jerusalem and the West Bank. And the hospitals there already. A second medical corridor to Egypt should be opened again, and maybe to Jordan. And from there, you know, when other countries are willing to receive patients, can go to other areas. Now, on Kamal Adwan, just a few details then. I think maybe I'll provide. So there is currently 3 medical doctors there, 2 pediatricians, 1 general physician, 30 nurses, 120 inpatients. Well, of which we took 23 patients, so currently less than 100. What they really want, besides this continuation of medical supplies and fuel and food for staff and patients, they need a specific medical specialist. They need a general surgeon, vascular surgeon, orthopedic surgeon, because what I said, the emergency department is full of patients, more than 40 casualties, and they don't have a general surgeon. Inpatient department also full of hospitalized patients. On the, you asked about the strike. I think that was on Kamal Adwan. I think I described that, and I just want to say for WHO, we are very clear. We have a mandate to monitor, to analyze as good as possible, and report on attacks on healthcare. We never attribute. We are not a crime investigating organization. We are a health organization. I'm a medical doctor, I'm a public health physician, so we don't do that. So we do not attribute. So I cannot, also I wouldn't even know what and how. And I think, and that also applies for that water strike. I think you've seen the reports in the media about that, and also from the various parties, et cetera. I actually was at that, I visited 6 sites on that first day on polio, and I was at that site as well, et cetera, which was lightly struck. You've seen the reports. I cannot say anything about that, because we are not investigating that. We just hear that, we get the pictures, we've been there, we've seen the damage, and that's it. Now, on the, there was one, I think I answered probably all your questions. Thank you. Over to you.
Thank you very much. But I see Nina has a follow-up.
Thank you. So just on the strike on the polio site, I know if you're not attributing blame or anything, but it would be interesting to know sort of your thoughts on the fact that a polio site was hit when this has been, you have the humanitarian pause that's supposed to be in place to allow the vaccination to go ahead. And if you could say maybe just a little bit more about the impact that's had on the vaccination. Thanks.
Okay, so for WHO, and I think, and UNICEF, for all of us, it's very clear that we expect that humanitarian area specific pauses are respected. And that's what also we came out straight away with, I think, with the information on that one. That's what we expect. Whatever happens, et cetera, and even people say it was a light attack and the wall slightly damaged, I think, 1 ambulance. And even that, I mean, like, of course, it should never happen. But I'm not going to go into detail, because that's not what we are doing, like what or how and we're not attributing that, because we don't also, we literally don't know. And you've seen the reports probably from all parties, what was transferred, what kind of information was transferred to that. How did it affect the polio campaign? I think it was again, I really applaud the resilience of the technical committee and all the partners present, who kept their head cool and continued, and actually on the second or third day deployed many more mobile teams, and which was strategically a very wise decision, and actually covered more kids than personally me I expected. I mean, like, I had a, because this last leg of the campaign in the north was compromised from the reasons I already shared. And I think in that situation, the teams did a fantastic job and covered way more children than actually we expected. Yeah, so good job. And I think the campaign itself was very little affected by this incident. Over to you.
Thank you very much. Jamie Keaton, Associated Press.
Good morning, Dr. Peppercorn. Thank you for coming to see us again. I was wondering if you could, you alluded to the 282 people who have been evacuated from Gaza since May 6th, if I understood you correctly. Could you tell us when those people were evacuated, and going to the 113 that I think you said roughly that are going to be evacuated tomorrow, as it seems, could you tell us a little bit about the ailments that they have? Are these chronic diseases? Are they injuries? What could you just give us like a nutshell as to what kind of cases that these people are showing?
Okay, it's a range of of cases. It's a lot of them are trauma and trauma related, and some of them are chronic. So it's an I would say probably 50%, but a lot of them, what I've seen up till now from the 282 patients, the ones I saw, most of them were trauma or related to the ongoing crisis and war. Roughly, it's difficult to estimate. I think at least one third are also children. And then, of course, you don't only talk about the patients, you also talk about companions. Over to you.
Go ahead.
When were the 282 evacuated?
Oh, yeah. So, sorry. I just got a call. Sorry. And the 282, since the Rafah crossing was closed on the 6th of May, so there was no possibility for medevac. So that was after 7 May. Yeah, after 7 May. So the Rafah crossing was closed 6th or 7th May. So since that time, only 282 critical patients have been medevaced outside Gaza. So tomorrow will be another batch, etc. And I say we as WHO, we support all these medevacs. We manage, we get them together. We not only then we get them together, we from all the various hospitals, then we get them together the day before the medevac on one location. We provide food, shelter, etc., and of course treatment together with respective hospitals and partners. And then on we make sure that they get transported this long convoy to Kerem Shalom. On the other side, they are received by another WHO team and partners.
Rick, there is some confusion here. Maybe, Jamie.
I'm just trying to find out when the last medevac was, basically, is my question.
Precisely.
Oh, the last medevac was, the last medevac was, if I remember, when I was also here in Gaza. So that must be.
Oh, you can tell us.
Five weeks ago.
Okay. Jeremy. Jeremy Lange, Radio France Internationale.
Yeah, just to elaborate a bit more on the medevac. is it going to happen tomorrow? Or are you still waiting for the green light of the Israeli authorities to get the medevac? Because you're saying that the last one was 5 weeks ago, but just like humanitarian convoys in the north that have been denied on multiple times, did that thing happen? Like you said, like 5 weeks ago was the last medevac, but since then, did you had like denials for medevac for the past 5 weeks? So bottom line is it going to happen tomorrow for sure?
I have good hope for that, because in general, the medevac operations, let's say exiting Gaza, we have been, when there is a possibility, we've been facilitated. So yes, I have good hope that this will happen.
Thank you. Just for those journalists who've asked, as Tariq has put in the chat, the notes of Rick's briefing will be distributed soon. Before I go to the platform, Nina, you have a follow-up on another question?
Sorry, it's just a clarification. So on the medevac that had happened between May 6th and now the 282, that didn't happen in one go, did it? It was, or is this the largest medevac that's happened since May 6th?
I think it's one of the larger ones. I think the former one, I mean, which we was reported on, was also pretty, was also approximately the same size.
Okay, let me go to the platform. Isabel Sacco, EFE.
Good morning, thank you. Just a short one on the vaccination campaign. I saw just this morning the Palestinian Ministry of Health announcing the extension today of the vaccination in northern Gaza, because they say that they will achieve the 90% coverage. And you said that there are just some polio activity today. So I would like to confirm just that a formal the end day of the vaccination campaign is today, and the activities of vaccination are still going on today. Thank you.
I think today is the fourth day. There are still some polio activities going on in fixed sites. I think in four fixed sites, and probably today and probably tomorrow. And I think there's four fixed sites. I think they're mainly fixed sites, primary healthcare centers where that takes place. So an attempt to wrap up and actually get hopefully the last children still being vaccinated today. Yeah, but it's not a proper campaign. It's an activities at four fixed sites.
All right, I don't see. Yeah, but no, Jamie.
Hi, again, sorry about this. I wanted to know if you have any comment about the reported detention of a Palestinian man who was with his grandchild being evacuated to southern Gaza. Do you know anything about that? Do you have any comment on it?
Excuse me, I didn't get the question.
I was wondering if you could give a comment about the reported detention of a Palestinian man who was with his grandchild during who was being evacuated to southern Gaza. Are you aware of that case, and do you have any comment on it? If so,
I don't have many comments. I'm aware of that, and the UN is trying to follow up on that.
Thank you, Rick. Don't see other hands up, so thank you very much for this exhaustive briefing. Thank you so much for keeping us informed. But we'll stay with WHO. Tariq, you are online, and you have brought us Dr. Mateusz Hasso-Agopsovic, I hope I pronounced well, Technical Officer and Project Manager for the Vaccine Product and Delivery Research, who's joining in from Poland. Maybe I'll give the floor first to Tariq to introduce the subject, and then we'll go to the doctor.
Thank you very much, Alexandra. Many thanks to Rick.
Indeed. Thank you very much.
Joining today also, many thanks to his team that will prepare the notes that we will share as soon as possible by email, so you get all the numbers, especially on the polio vaccination. So let's just turn to something a little bit different. This morning you have received the press release where WHO lists for the first time the diseases that should be prioritized when it comes to development of vaccines. And I know maybe some of you may wonder what is the difference between the priority list, pathogen list that we have been issuing previous years, and the last one was end of July. But the difference is that priority pathogen list is for the diseases with pandemic potential, and it's really about the research and development on all aspects of getting to know better the pathogen than all the tools like the diagnostics, therapeutics, including vaccines. Today, we are just really speaking about vaccines for diseases that we know and for which we don't have vaccines yet. So you have the press release, and I give the floor to Dr. Mateusz Haso-Agospowicz to tell us more about that.
Thank you so much, Tariq, and good morning, colleagues. So I'm here today to talk to you that WHO has published today a major study where we had identified 17 bacteria, viruses, and parasites, which we collectively call pathogens, that frequently cause diseases as top priorities for developing and researching new vaccines. This study is the first global effort where we systematically prioritize endemic pathogens based on the impact that they make in regions, but also globally. Why do we do this? Well, we need to do this because we would like to shift the focus from developing vaccines away from commercial returns toward regional and global health needs. So what typically has happened in the past is that vaccine research and development has been influenced by profitability of new vaccines. What that means is that diseases that severely affect low-income regions unfortunately receive much less attention. And with this WHO study, we hope this represents a critical shift where we want to change the focus from commercial perspective, profitability of new vaccines, towards the actual health burden, so that the new vaccine research and development is driven by health burden and not just commercial opportunities. How did we do this? Well, we employed something that is called multi-criteria decision analysis. This is a systematic approach where we had asked experts about what do they think is important when prioritizing which pathogens, for which pathogens do we need to develop vaccines. We asked these experts about criteria like deaths, disease, socioeconomic impact, or resistance of these pathogens. And we had asked experts that have expertise in pathogen epidemiology, clinicians, pediatricians, vaccine experts from all of the WHO regions, so that to ensure that the list and the results that we produce, they really reflect the needs of diverse populations worldwide. So what have we found? The findings reconfirm some long-standing vaccine priorities. For example, HIV, malaria, and tuberculosis, they come to the top priorities as major global health threats. They collectively cause around 2.5 million deaths a year. However, the study also raises importantly attention to new pathogen priorities. For example, group A streptococcus, which causes severe infections and contributes to 280,000 deaths from rheumatic heart disease, mainly in low-income countries. Another example of a new priority for vaccine research and development is Klebsiella pneumonia, a bacteria that is associated with 790,000 deaths and is responsible for 40% of neonatal deaths due to infections of the blood, the sepsis, in low-income countries. So two examples of pathogens that have a very large burden, particularly in low-income countries. In order to advance the development of vaccines against these priority pathogens, we had categorized these pathogens based on where vaccines against these pathogens are in development, but also what are the technical challenges to develop these vaccines. So do we know what immunity profiles are there with these vaccines? Do we have appropriate tools to develop these vaccines? Or once vaccines have developed, can we pay for them and can we deliver these vaccines to those who need them the most? And based on these needs, we had categorized vaccines from research to advanced development and to prepare for regulatory decision, vaccine introduction, and scale up in countries. Overall, we hope that we expect that this study will lead to impact, which is guiding future investment, research and development investments. For example, for funders, they can use this list to be able to identify for which pathogens they need to fund research studies, they need to fund clinical research in order to accelerate the development of these important vaccines. For researchers, they could use that list in order to conduct research to overcome challenges to vaccine development associated with these priority pathogens. For vaccine developers, they can use that list as guiding principle to say, okay, for these priority pathogens, this is what we should be developing vaccines against. And lastly, for policymakers and country decision makers, so that they can look at this list, they can assess this as a priority, and on that basis, they can decide whether to introduce these vaccines into the immunization programs, and also they can scale up the introduction of these vaccines in their countries against high priority pathogens. Thank you, colleagues.
Thank you very much, Matthews, for this. Questions to WHO on this matter? I see Isabel again from EFE, the Spanish news agency. Go ahead, Isabel.
Yes, good morning. I would like to ask if two things. Firstly, if you can confirm or comment on the fact that many of these illnesses in the list are, as you said, illnesses that happens mostly in low-income countries. And the problem has been always that there is a low commercial interest to develop these products. So how to make more interesting for producers, laboratories and producers to manufacture this, develop and manufacture these vaccines, and not to stay in few years in the same point that we are now. This is one thing. And the other thing that you have divided your list in three categories. And the last one is pathogens where vaccines are approaching regulatory approval. And we see there dengue, streptococcus, group B, and so on. So how close these approvals are for these vaccines, and what is the timeline we could expect to have once they have been approved to have vaccines for example, commercially already in the market for dengue and the other E. coli and the other illnesses. Thank you.
Matthews, go ahead.
Sure. Thank you so much for these questions. So the first question is whether these diseases happen predominantly in low-income countries. There are examples, majority of the pathogens and diseases that we list on that list affect low- and middle-income countries. There are examples that are just for low-income countries, like Plasmodium falciparum, which causes malaria. You can see in the chart that it actually it's a disease that is predominantly being prioritized in the African region, so it affects majority of low-income countries. But there are also some examples of diseases that are happening in low-income countries and in high-income countries. One example of that would be something that we call XPEC, which is an E. coli that infects different parts of the body, and it causes actually neonatal sepsis. So very young babies can die from an infection with E. coli within the first 28 days of life. And that happens predominantly in low-income countries. But you have another presentation of that disease, for example, in the elderly, where they get severe pneumonia, where they get meningitis, and that is often happening in higher income countries, also because we see very high levels of resistance associated with that pathogens. So yes, the list is predominantly about low income countries, but you have some examples of diseases that are also happening in high income countries. And your question about how can we make these vaccines more interesting to producers? I think I've mentioned in the past that producers, they were very much driven by commercial opportunity, but at the same time, they've never received any guidance, any steering as to if we would like to develop vaccines for low-income countries, which vaccines we should be developing. And with this list, we're hoping that we give them guidance, we give them steering. They know what to look forward to, and they know which vaccines they should start producing, and they start doing so. How we can increase the attractiveness of developing these vaccines. One way could be to partner with funders, could be to partner with research institutions. Now, some of these funders are willing to invest, to share money to in order to advance the development of these vaccines for low-income countries, for example, against Klebsiella pneumonia, against tuberculosis, etc., so that the funding is provided for the early stages of diseases. Another example of how to make it more interesting is to consider dual markets. And like in the example of E. coli that I just gave, you could, for example, develop one vaccine that could be suitable for use in low-income countries to prevent neonatal sepsis. And then with minor modification, it could also be suitable to high-income country markets where it brings investments and then it pays off the partial investments for that vaccine to go to low-income country. You have also asked about the last category of vaccines. These are the vaccines that approach regulatory approval, policy decision, and vaccine introduction and scale up. And you have asked how quickly we can expect for these vaccines to be available. So some of these vaccines that are in that group have actually already been licensed during the time of this exercise. An example here is dengue that received a policy decision in March last year. Another example is malaria that also has received a policy decision and is being introduced to some countries. So there are examples of some vaccines that are already being approved. So now the matter for them is to be introduced to countries' immunization programs and then scaled up in the right populations. For the remaining vaccines, Group B streptococcus, phase 3 trials for that vaccine are yet starting. And then that may cost, 3 to 5 years before such a vaccine will become available. But what we wanted to highlight in this message, that given that the clinical development is already so advanced, countries need to start thinking about which priority populations would they give this vaccine to? How would they identify these priority innovations? Who would they need to partner up in order to identify funding to pay for these vaccines? And how would they be able to introduce them? So it very much depends on pathogens that are in development, but it's between 3 to 5 years. And we want to highlight, some critical actions that we need to already start thinking to prepare for the introduction of these vaccines.
Indeed, that's also explained in the press release that we received now. Any other question to WHO? Isabel, you have a follow-up?
Yes, also very short, thank you. Do you have an idea of what is the expected production of vaccines for dengue and tuberculosis this year? Thank you.
So just to summarize for dengue, we have two vaccines that have been licensed. So one vaccine is a vaccine from a Japanese manufacturer, and that vaccine has received a policy decision from WHO in September this year, and that vaccine is recommended for use in those who have already been exposed to dengue. There is another vaccine from the Brazilian manufacturer, which is had the results of efficacy from that vaccine at the beginning of this year. I think it was around February. So for dengue, the production is being scaled up. Countries are considering the introduction of these vaccines based on their local evidence, based on what they know about efficacy of this vaccine, and based on modeling as to how important that vaccine could be for their population. Specifics about the production and manufacturing and the number of doses, I'm not able to provide that. I don't have such a knowledge. For tuberculosis, we have, I assume that you are referring to new vaccines in development against tuberculosis. We have the most advanced candidate. One vaccine is, it's called M72 vaccine. It's called M72 because of the protein that it has in that vaccine. And this is a vaccine that will be given to adults and adolescents who are already infected with latent tuberculosis. And that vaccine would prevent from progression to active tuberculosis. That vaccine has just started phase 3 trials, which are funded by international funders. And that trial is expected to finish around 2027. The reason why it takes so long is because within the trial, a person who is vaccinated or not vaccinated, some of them, they need to become sick with tuberculosis. And it takes a lot of time for TB to be able to develop and to be able to become active. It takes around minimum the duration of the trial, which is around 3 years. This is why the trial takes so long. There is also another vaccine which is a vaccine that will be targeted to infants, to protect infants, and then perhaps later through additional immunization for adult life to protect against pulmonary disease. And that vaccine is also in phase 3 trial. So I think for a vaccine against tuberculosis, we are not looking for earlier than 2028, 2029 to have some considerations about early introduction. And just importantly, also Gavi, you know, the organization that pays for vaccines for low-income countries, they have very much considered tuberculosis vaccines and is one of their priorities to be able to finance one once it becomes available.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mateusz. I don't see other questions for you. So before closing with WHO, I'd like to pass the floor to Tariq again for an announcement.
Thank you. Thank you, Alessandra. So just to make an announcement, you will get the media advisory later today, but we will have a press conference this Thursday, day after tomorrow at 2 o'clock. And that's ahead of COP29 that will take place in Baku from 11 to 22nd November. We will have Dr. Maria Neira, that you know very well, Dr. Diarmid Campbell-Landrum, Dr. Vanessa Carey, who is Director General Special Envoy for Climate Change and Health, and Elizabeth E. We will present new documents on the health initiatives that will take place at the COP29. And also discuss health arguments for immediate and decisive action by climate negotiators at that conference. In these documents are under are available under embargo, and basically we try to stress the importance of positioning health at the core of all climate negotiations. So you will see the media advisory, and you will see how to obtain the documents under embargo. Again, press conference is at 2 o'clock on Thursday.
Tariq, are you speaking about Thursday, the 7th of November?
Yes.
Yeah, let's have a little discussion on that, because we have a press conference already announced for 1:30. So let's see if we can adjust a little bit the timing one way or the other, in order to have both. And that press conference, I was going to remind you, on the 7th of November, it's at 1:30, so HCHR, and it's the Human Rights Committee presenting the findings on Ecuador, France, Greece, Iceland, Pakistan, and Turkey. That has been already announced. So let's see with WHO and the colleagues of OHCHR if we can adjust a little bit the timing. But thank you very much, Tariq. Thanks for bringing us the two speakers of today. As I said, a couple of reminders. One is the Human Rights Committee. The press conference comes as they close their session on Thursday itself. Also on the committees, there is the Committee Against Torture, which begins this morning the review of the report of Thailand. The other countries to be examined are Jordan, Mongolia, Cameroon, and then in the morning of the 14th November, the committee will hold a high-level event for the 40th anniversary of the Convention Against Torture. The colleagues of WIPO have asked me to remind you that on the 6th of November, so the day before, on Wednesday, at 11 a.m., there will be a virtual-only press conference for the release of the World Intellectual Property Indicators Report, showing global intellectual property statistics from countries across the globe. This is an embargoed press conference. The embargo is lifted on Thursday, 7th of November at 9:30 Geneva time. The speaker will be Carsten Fink, the chief economist of WIPO. And Ed has asked me to tell you that you will be receiving all the press material under embargo today. And they will send you the Zoom link tomorrow as usual. So the same day of the press conference, just ahead of the beginning of the press conference. Last press conference I wanted to remind you of is the one organized by FAO, to launch the State of Food and Agriculture 2024. That's the media launch, and it's also under embargo because the report will be presented on the 8th of November at 10 Rome time. So you will have the embargo press conference with Andrea Cattaneo, FAO senior economist and lead author of the report. And I think this is what I had for you. Just one thing, because two things, in fact. One thing that I've been asked, and I can confirm that tomorrow, Wednesday, 6th of November at 10 a.m. New York time, so that's now again 4 p.m. in Geneva, as they are back also to the change of the hour in the States, at 10 a.m. in the General Assembly Hall. There will be an informal meeting of the plenary, of the General Assembly plenary, to hear a briefing on UNRWA. Some of you had asked whether this briefing was broadcast, and it is broadcast on UN Web TV and CG, and Commissioner General Lazzarini will brief the Assembly. That's something that I've been asked, so I can confirm this. And just a very, very last point, on the 14th of November, we will have, as we had last year, the commemoration of what we call the Futur en tout genre. That's the day, I think you, those of you who have children know, that it's a day where you bring your children to the office. They can see not only the job of their parents, but also the environment, the working environment. As last year, we are organizing a small event for children, not only of the staff, but also of the journalists. You are invited to bring your children if you wish. Just let us know, because we need to know how many children we will have that day. I know some of you have already registered, but just wanted to put it on record. If people want to bring their children to the office that day, let us know. There will be a mock-up press conference, so they will probably understand better when you tell them that you do meeting press coverage at the UN. They will probably understand better what moment that does do for a living. Isabel, I see you have your hand up.
Yes, thank you. What's for Tariq? I don't know if he's still there, but it's to know if the information given in the press in the survey press conference will be under embargo or not, free to use on the same day.
I think Tariq is still online, so I'll give him the floor.
Yeah, thanks. We will work with Alessandra on a specific timing, so we don't clash with the press conference that that Alessandra mentioned. But basically, the embargo will lift at the end of the press conference. That's the idea. If you wish, there is a 1 hour embargo, but otherwise, no. But again, you will have more in a media advisory that will be sent out today, and we will work on the time. Thank you.
And I see Emma. Thank you. Emma sends a message saying that she missed the answer. No worries. We'll send it to you again. But basically, it's not much to announce, that if you want your children to participate, just let us know. Just let Rolando know, and we will enroll it in the day. But we will try to send a separate message on this. Anybody else? I don't see hands up. So thank you very much, and bon appétit, and I'll see you on Friday. Thank you.